This podcast is brought to you by Minimal Productions, producer Jim Mintz.
This is Diplomates, a geopolitical chinwag with your host, Misha Zielinski.
Nicole Hemmer is an associate research scholar at Columbia University. A prominent American historian, she's the author of Messengers of the Right, Conservative Media and the Transformation of American Politics. She's a columnist for CNN, as well as the host of the podcast Past Present and This Day in Esoteric Political History. I caught up with Nicole for a chinwag about the shocking events of 6 January at the US Capitol, what the hell the QAnon conspiracy theory is all about, President Trump's culpability in all of this, the role of right-wing media in radicalizing politics, how social media giants can be held to account for promoting misinformation, what history tells us about the dangers of ignoring extremist movements, and how we can save democracy. I should also say from the outset, we've had a bit of a break, I think it's 2 months since our last episode, so apologies for those of you who've been waiting. I have been sidetracked with the project, which I can tell you about now. You might have seen I released a book of essays called The Right Stuff, Voices of Unity on Labour's Future. It's all about the future of progressive politics in Australia, the Labour Party specifically. It features 30 essays from 30 leading Labour thinkers. It's a fantastic read. Thank you so much to everyone who contributed. If you are interested, check out the show notes. I've got a link to the book there. I'd love for you to buy a copy and tell me what you think. Also, if you aren't following me already on Twitter or following the show, at Misha Zielinski or at Diplomate Show on Instagram and Twitter, I'm really enjoying all the feedback and chatter. Also, if you're interested, and I'm sure you're really going to enjoy this episode with Nicole, jump on Twitter, follow her at Past Punditry, check out the show notes. There's links to her podcasts there, which are also absolutely outstanding. So check those out. You really enjoy them. I'll shut up now. Enjoy the episode. Nicole, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, there's so much we can talk about. We'll obviously get into the shocking events last week in DC at the Capitol. But I thought a place to start might be sort of going right to some fundamental, some definitional stuff relating to conspiracy theories. And you know, for an Australian audience, it might be useful for you perhaps here to explain, you know, what is QAnon and who are they? What do they believe in? I suppose, why do they suddenly matter? Some people have been following it, but suddenly sometimes things spring up out of nowhere. So this whole QAnon conspiracy theory, could you give us a quick rundown of that?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to sound bizarre, as conspiracy theories often do out of context, but this grew out of a conspiracy that your audience might be familiar with called Pizzagate, which was this idea that Democratic office holders were engaged in a child porn ring or a child pedophilia ring. And Q has that. It also believes that it's not just child pornography, but human trafficking and Satanism and cannibalism, that all of these things are practiced by elites in the United States. And that Donald Trump is the one person who can bring this all down, that he's going to rise up and take out the deep state. He's going to take out all of these pedophile rings. He's going to expose all of the Democrats. He has all the information necessary to put a stop to all of these evils that Q is telling us about. And so Q is the sort of person or entity at the heart of all of this. In 2017, over on first 4chan and then 8chan and 8kun, which are all of these image boards, Q appeared as somebody who said that he had inside information and would do these, what are now known as Q drops, where he would give sort of Nostradamus-like hints at what was coming. And then you would have all of these Facebook groups and Reddit groups that would set about trying to decode these Q drops. And this has become probably the most significant conspiracy theory in the United States today.
And so, and it's interesting, I mean, Pizzagate, you know, as nutty as that one is, I mean, that eventually someone actually went to that pizza restaurant trying to rescue children in the basement. So, I mean, it's quite scary, the link between real life and these conspiracies. But what is the role of conspiracy theories, I suppose, in right-wing politics? Because, I mean, there seems to be now a transfer of them from, I guess, the dark edges of the web to the center of political life.
Yeah, I mean, the right in the U.S. has always been vulnerable to different kinds of conspiracies. We see this back in the 1950s with something like the John Birch Society, which argued that Dwight Eisenhower, who was the president, was a known conspirator with the communists in the Soviet Union, that fluoride was being put in the waters in order to control people's minds. And those are kind of the wackier, wilder parts of these conspiracies, but they're attached to conspiracies that it's a little easier to believe, right? So that communists are around every corner and trying to take down the United States, or in the case of Q, that there's a deep state that is trying to take down Donald Trump. Those are kind of the entryway conspiracies that then lead people down a path to something more. And so it's something that we see a lot in American politics, just more broadly. It's just that they've moved to the center in part because of various media and in part because you have somebody like Donald Trump, who's kind of the conspiracist in chief, who loves these conspiracies himself.
It's a bit more than just Trump, though, which is sort of the disconcerting part of it. I mean, how concerned are you about the fact that there are, I suppose, there are open conspiracy theorists in the House and the Senate, certainly on the Republican side of the aisle?
I mean, it's very good evidence that this is not just a fringe group, that there are actually people in the Congress who espouse QAnon beliefs. I mean, we'll talk in a little bit about the insurrection at the Capitol, but a lot of the people involved were people who believe in QAnon. And just like in the Pizzagate conspiracy, where somebody, as you mentioned, not only went to Comet Pizza, but went there with a gun and started shooting. There's a link between this fervid belief in conspiracies and violence.
Well, I mean, so you've mentioned the link between, you know, conspiracy and violence, which is probably a good entry point into the Capitol, the insurrection. You know, I mean, in some ways it was so shocking, and in other ways it almost felt like the logical endpoint of Trumpism. I mean, do you think this was an inevitable consequence of sort of stirring up these conspiracy theories, bringing them to the center, and then continuing to force feed what is a lie and, you know, and repeating it to the point where, you know, if you believe something is true and if you're told that the government has basically been taken over by, you know, pedophiles or what have you, and that they've stolen an election, that the president says you must take it back by force. I mean, these things are, it's almost like it feels almost inevitable that this would be the consequence of that type of behavior. Is that, do you see it that way?
Yeah, I might not use the word inevitable, but I would use the word overdetermined. There's so much that started to push people in this direction. And you're exactly right. If you genuinely believe that the election has been stolen, if you believe that the people who have stolen it are not just criminals, but genuinely evil people, why wouldn't you grab your gun and go to the Capitol? And a lot of the people there, I'm not saying everybody who went to the Capitol believed in the QAnon conspiracy, but I will tell you that they all believed that the election had been stolen, something that doesn't have any evidence, in fact, has been disproven again and again. And so yeah, this has been riled up again and again over 4 years among a population that was already pretty anti-government in some ways and was already armed and tended to see itself in the revolutionary tradition in the United States. So Donald Trump finally selling them on this big lie about the election, it didn't have to happen. There were a lot of things that went wrong that allowed them to breach the U.S. Capitol building itself. But something like this was very likely to happen.
And what's the role of the president specifically in sort of, I suppose, legitimizing these conspiracy theories? Because they seem very quickly to be coming from Q drops into social media, sort of algorithmic, it's being pushed around into that kind of ecosystem. Then they're finding their way somehow to the president, who then repeats them, which then becomes proof of the fact that it exists, and on it goes. What's his specific role in this?
So the president is really important for legitimizing all of this, right? Because if it were just a bunch of conspiracy kooks out in the corners of the internet, certainly some people pushed there by algorithms, pushed there through radicalization networks would find QAnon. But that it is attached to a president who speaks in very conspiratorial terms, who pushes conspiracy theories of his own, and like Q, uses really elliptical language that you can read anything you want into. Those qualities really help him mesh neatly with the world of people who believe in conspiracy theories. And so he acts as a sort of reactant on all of these conspiracies, metastasizing them into something that's much more mainstream and much more dangerous.
And the fact that it's, I suppose, the president, the leader of the country, I mean, this has never been seen before. It shows, I suppose, how important the words of a leader are or not in a democracy. I mean, you can't really safeguard against someone peddling conspiracy theory. So, I mean, how do you actually push back against something like that from the president?
So you would need a lot of things that we don't have. You would need other political elites within the Republican Party who were trusted by Trump's base to come out and say what he is saying is untrue. You would need the media system that they trust in to come out and say what he is saying is untrue. And even then, I'm not sure that you could convince people who are already convinced about a conspiracy that they're wrong. I mean, we saw what happened with Fox News whenever it called the election for Joe Biden. It lost a lot of viewers because they felt like they could no longer trust Fox News. So having the most powerful man in the country and potentially the most powerful man in the world espousing these conspiracies, even though he's been taken off Twitter and all of these things, you can't actually deplatform the president because he's the president of the United States. As long as he holds that position, there's not a lot you can do.
And so before we sort of get into, I suppose, the ecosystem and sort of the bigger questions, let's sort of stay with the insurrection itself. You know, there's some of the discourse that's come out now is that, you know, some of the talking points we've seen certainly from Republicans or more right-wing punditry is that, well, this is a bit whataboutism, you know. So, well, we had Black Lives Matter protests and there was violence engaged there, and so this is all kind of the same and we condemn all violence. So, I mean, is that a fair comparison, or is this what happened at the Capitol special case that should be treated differently?
It is absolutely a special case, and I want to pull apart some of that because it's important to understand a couple of different things. First, at a lot of the Black Lives Matter protests over the summer, the main source of violence were the police. I mean, some of these were police riots where so much of the violence was coming from police officers and law enforcement themselves, whether it was running down protesters with their cars or beating them with clubs. So that's part of this. Flashback to this summer when the president turned the entire infrastructure of federal law enforcement against peaceful protesters standing outside the White House. One of those instances that we were talking about then as unprecedented uses of presidential power and force, that wasn't being used against people who were trying to break into the White House. That was being used against people who were basically like milling around outside the White House. So that's very different in those two ways. But also, what happened at the U.S. Capitol is unprecedented in American history. We can talk about some precedents that it draws from and that it's similar to, but in terms of having a president stir up a conspiracy theory, direct a mob to Congress, and for that Congress then to not only break into the Capitol, but go hunting for members of Congress and the Vice President of the United States to hang them at a gallows that they had set up outside of the U.S. Capitol, if we start comparing that to other things that happened in U.S. history, we are watering it down and we're not being honest about what happened. So we can talk about the history of political violence in the U.S. We can talk about other times the Capitol has been breached, but all of those things are just not the same as what we saw on the 6th.
That was, I mean, you put that very succinctly and very perfectly and shockingly. Were you surprised after the violence about the high number of, certainly in the House, of Republicans that voted still to overturn the results of the election, I suppose, because there was a little bit of perhaps of, you could say there might have been some cosplay associated or people perhaps not understanding exactly what they were doing going along with the president, but they bore witness to what happened and yet still came in and said that the election was a fraud and should be overturned. I mean, that to me was shocking in of itself.
Yeah, that was the moment when I realized that this wasn't going to really change anything, at least in the short term, when it came to the basic dysfunctions of not just U.S. politics, but of the Republican Party, that you could have been physically attacked and then go right back to selling a lie that you know is a lie. I mean, this is not just, you know, members of Congress who were tricked into thinking this or who firmly believe that the election was stolen. We have the evidence that shows that this is not, this election was not stolen. And so to reinforce the lie that people just sacked the Congress in order to uphold is frankly appalling and pretty disgusting, because it shows a preference for sort of shoring up your political career over protecting the country.
And before we sort of go right back to history, one of the things I sort of wanted to ask your opinion on, because you are a historian in these matters, is when did this process begin? Because, you know, you can look at the Trump presidency, you could the 2016 election and what went on with Hillary Clinton relating to Benghazi and that sort of conspiracy theory. But then you obviously had birtherism in the first term of Obama's presidency. But it strikes me, if you can go back even further, you can look at Bill Clinton's presidency and the sort of Whitewater conspiracy theories and the way that Newt Gingrich's House pursued his presidency with, you know, essentially things that were fabricated, not so much in the incident, the way that we understand it now, but in these sort of right-wing, nutty conspiracy theory lands. I mean, this ecosystem, how long has it been going, and what are its elements?
So historians are always going to want to try to push you further and further back in time. But I think that
I can only remember back as far as 94. That's my problem.
That's right. I remember back a little bit further than that, but I actually think the 1990s is a pretty good place to start. There are the conspiracies about the president that were very similar to the ones that we saw about Barack Obama, the constant investigations, the notion that his presidency was illegitimate from the very start. But that was also a time of growing right-wing white power terrorism in the United States. Remember, 1995 is when the Oklahoma City bombing happens, and that was carried out by white power activists, by militias who were really peaking in the 1990s. And the 1990s are the decade of the birth and spread of both right-wing talk radio and of Fox News and all of those like crazy zines and early internet sites that helped to spread a lot of these Clinton conspiracies. So if you're looking at the elements that you need for where we are today, I think you can point to the 1990s as a major source of them.
And so, you know, you touched on history. I mean, what does history teach us about sort of, I suppose, excusing bad behavior? Because there's an element now saying, well, let's just move on from what happened at the Capitol, and, you know, perhaps, you know, a new presidency, perhaps we shouldn't, you know, prosecute old fights or what have you. I mean, what sort of concern would you have about sort of just passing that off?
I have a lot of concerns about it, because I think that if you don't strongly address something like this, an insurrection in the US that was supported by members of the government, then you're giving people license to just go do it again. And I think we can see that a couple of places in US history. One, just as we're thinking about Joe Biden taking office, you know, in 1974, when Richard Nixon resigned from office rather than be impeached and removed, Gerald Ford, who had been his vice president, becomes president. And one of his first acts of office is to pardon Richard Nixon. And he went from being a pretty popular president to being a pretty unpopular president overnight, because people wanted investigations. They wanted to understand what had happened to their democracy, and they wanted justice. And they didn't get any of those things. But if we take it much further back in US history and talk about the Civil War, what we saw after the Civil War, there was a deal made in 1877, which basically said, look, we're done enforcing civil rights in the South. Democrats, you can have the South. Do what you want with it. We'll take the federal government, the Republicans at the time, and we're all going to move on from what happened in the Civil War. We'll just agree that both sides really cared about what they were fighting for, and we all fought honorably, and we're all going to come together in unity again. And that unity was bought on the backs of Black Americans who were put into subservient second-class citizenship that would last until the 1960s. So unity comes at a price when the underlying evils, the underlying problems aren't addressed, and ones that can really cripple not just a nation and not just a people, but can really forestall the emergence of a just democracy. right? Democracy was delayed for another 100 years because of this, this Faustian bargain that the North and South, that white people in the North and South strike after the Civil War. And I think that's a real warning flag on the horizon as we look to move forward from this.
And so, yeah, that's a very powerful example. I mean, looking, you know, today, I mean, again, you talked a lot about the difference between what happened at the Capitol, what happened to Black Lives Matter protests, but is there a difference between the moral righteousness of some causes and the moral righteousness of others? Because we have very much devolved into both sides, what about is in punditry, right? So, oh, well, the left's angry and the right's angry, so the truth must be somewhere in the middle. I mean, is that an accurate way to view the world politically or not?
I think it's a pretty terrible way to view the world. It's actually an almost morality-free way of viewing the world. And it's a tactic that people use in order to avoid accountability. And I'll just draw one example from my own life. I was on the ground covering the events in Charlottesville, Virginia in 2017, which we can talk more about. But, you know, at the time, what did I see? I saw violent neo-Nazis clashing with anti-fascists who were protecting people who had committed themselves to nonviolence. And you're just never going to convince me that fascist violence and anti-fascist violence are equal. It matters what you're fighting for. And it's something that we understand in the context of state-sponsored violence. We understand when we look at World War II that one side was fighting for something good and one side was fighting for something bad. And within that, there might be nuances and conversations to have, but you understood that violence could be used for good and violence could be used for bad. And we need to apply that same crystal clear understanding to when we talk about civil unrest today, because it does matter what it's in pursuit of.
I mean, so you obviously then don't support the president's claims that there are good people on both sides in Charlottesville. But talking about Charlottesville specifically and those comments from the president, which is essentially to the point that you just made, I mean, do you think this is a turning point in the sort of modern political discourse in the United States? I mean, should the public and the US political class have done more then? I mean, what's the link between Charlottesville and what happened last week?
There were so many unlearned lessons from Charlottesville, which is frustrating. It's somebody who has been researching and writing and talking about this for the past 3 years. I mean, one thing that we see is, again, this very fine people rhetoric. People might forget that Charlottesville, the Unite the Right rally, was something that was being organized by people with very violent means, very violent goals, and very violent histories. And there were no very fine people who chose to rally with neo-Nazis and Klansmen. You're disqualifying yourself by making that kind of alliance. And what grew out of Charlottesville was this mythology and this conspiracy that flourished on the right, a sort of what they call a Charlottesville hoax that says, well, the president never actually said that, first of all. And second of all, Antifa was the source of all of the violence that happened in Charlottesville. So the Antifa myth is another thing that grows out of Charlottesville, this idea that all sources of political violence are Antifa.
For those who aren't familiar with Antifa, that is the so-called sort of left radicalist anti-fascist movement that's violent, built up by the right, but nevertheless, that's a sort of the counterbalance to the Proud Boys or what have you, which are the right-wing militia group. Is that a fair way to describe it, or how would you describe it?
Yeah, I would describe anti-fascist as a group, a pretty heterodox group, especially in terms of whether they think it's okay to use violence or not, but who show up whenever there are fascist groups gathering, and at least some of whom believe that it is proper and right to use violence to protect people and to end the threat of fascism. And that's a big debate within anti-fascist circles, but that's who they are. But they become, in the public imagination, Antifa, this kind of bogeyman that's responsible for all violence in the United States. That's how they've emerged over the past 3 years. The other big lesson of Charlottesville, and the thing that I had found so disturbing watching it unfold, is that there was a huge police presence in Charlottesville, and police officers across the board did almost nothing to stop the violence that was happening there, and saw when they looked out on the field the counter-protesters as the only possible source of violence and never took seriously right-wing violence as a threat to themselves or to the city. And this has been a persistent problem in the United States over the course of the Trump presidency, obviously much earlier than that as well. But even though the Department of Homeland Security says that right-wing violence is the most persistent and lethal threat in the United States, law enforcement still does not take right-wing protesters, right-wing mobs as serious threats. And we saw that again at the Capitol. There just was no serious police presence to prepare for what they knew was going to be a huge group of people, who some of whom had been planning online for weeks and weeks to bring violence to the Capitol. And that disconnect, that unwillingness to take white people seriously as sources of violence, is a real frustration watching January 6th unfold.
And so we've talked a bit about the role of right-wing media, I suppose, in stoking a lot of this. I mean, modern iteration, we're seeing a lot of social media, but the right-wing media ecosystem. I mean, how much do you hold them responsible for firstly radicalizing the Republican Party, and then secondly, I suppose, the events of last week? I mean, is it fair to draw that link, or do you think that it's a little more complex than that?
I do think it's more complex because we have to give people agency when it comes to their choices. And one of the things, again, you know, I mentioned how Fox News got some real blowback for calling the election for Joe Biden. The base has agency. When they are disturbed by something that they hear on conservative media, when they disagree with it, they make their dissatisfaction known. And that often changes what you get on talk radio or what you get on Fox News. They adapt to be where their audience is. So it's not just that they're putting out this radicalizing content that people are innocuously stumbling across and suddenly becoming much more right-wing or much more amenable to radicalism. There's an appetite out there for more radical content. That said, there is also a social media infrastructure that has, we have evidence that it pushes people towards more radical corners of the internet, towards more radical ideas, that algorithms expose people to all sorts of conspiracy sites and far-right radical sites and white power sites. And this has been a big problem with social media, that you know, all of these, this broader media ecosystem does not support de-radicalization. It does not support calm. It does not support sort of reasoned weighing of information, but in fact supports its opposite. It supports people indulging in conspiracy theories. It spreads conspiracy theories, and it is part of a process of radicalization. And so it is a huge part of trying to figure out the puzzle of what has happened in U.S. politics over the last 30 years.
It's interesting, though, because once upon a time, the media acted as a gatekeeper on information, whereas now it's becoming almost a clearinghouse, right? So you look at, once upon a time, it would have been unthinkable for a legitimate talking head on a major news network to repeat that the president's lie that the election had been stolen was in fact true when there's no evidence to support that, whereas now it's legitimizing it. Is there a way, I mean, that gatekeeping role is critical, but is there even a way that that could ever be restored, or is that gone forever?
It doesn't seem likely to be coming back anytime soon. It is true that media tend toward consolidation. And so you could imagine a world in which fact checkers and gatekeepers, we're seeing this moment right now, right, where Facebook and Twitter are suddenly exerting a lot of authority. I guess you could imagine a world where that becomes the norm. I just don't think that's going to happen, because when you talk about gatekeepers, I mean, here I'm talking about right-wing media and social media, but, you know, even news programs like the Sunday morning political chat shows are bringing on these people to spread conspiracies about the election. And that kind of just basic gatekeeping on real journalistic outlets has broken down. That I think you can begin to repair. I just don't know what you do for not only the collapse of faith in journalism and in media more broadly, but, you know, putting gatekeepers in place is a fraught thing to do. It is politically and technologically difficult to do. And if there's no real appetite for it and no real cultural support for it, it's just not going to get very far.
I think you're right, certainly about, again, sort of creating false equivalents where you have perhaps a scientist talking about climate change and a denialist, and you say, oh, there's two sides to the story, which then feels like it's 50-50 as compared to there's 99.9% of scientists' view that climate change is man-made and real versus a crank. But the way media is so biased towards having two voices or a balance, a faux balance, as it were, is certainly problematic. But even just looking at, you know, so many people talk about Fox News and the Murdoch machine. But, I mean, with the rise of things like the One America Network, Breitbart, I mean, even if it's interesting you talk about the betrayal of the audience in respect to calling the election in the favour of Joe Biden from Fox News. Is it even too late to put the genie back in the bottle in that sense? I mean, this fragmentation seems to be happening more and more on the right and chasing that audience. I mean, it doesn't seem like it could even necessarily be fixed by Fox, you know, getting its house in order if that was possible.
And nor do I think that Fox is particularly interested at the moment in getting its house in order. I mean, the only change it's made since the election is to take one of its two evening news hours and turn one of them into opinion. So they know that their audience wants Newsmax. And if they need to be Newsmax in order to compete, that's who they're going to become. So I think that, you know, not only do you have a sort of technological and cultural situation that pushes towards fragmentation, the easy ability to create content that an audience craves. It wouldn't have been possible for a network like Newsmax or OAN to compete 20 years earlier because it used to cost a ton of money to start up a television station. Now it costs a lot less because of digital media. So there's not necessarily that appetite for that kind of media. And as long as all of the incentives are pushing in one direction, if all of the money is over there on the far right, and if all of the political power is over there on the far right, then that's where these networks and outlets are going to go, because that's where the incentives are pushing them.
Now, I just want to ask you something, and it's on topic, but it's a bit more, I suppose, esoteric, and it relates to the difference, I suppose, between an opinion and misinformation. And so, and where, how do we tell the difference? So, for example, you can have right-wing news opinion to say Barack Obama was a poor president for these reasons. That may or may not be true, but it's an opinion. It's a valid opinion because, you know, it's contestable. Versus Barack Obama was born in Kenya, which is a complete misinformation fact, misinformation and fake assertion. So where do you tell the difference, and how do you delineate between the two? Because they have become so meshed that it's become almost impossible to do so, to my mind.
Yeah, I mean, they're very much meshed. And I think that they're particularly meshed in ideological political media, right? Conservative media exists to give you a conservative spin on whatever they're saying. So the opinion is embedded in the very product itself. But I think the difference is just as you were saying, like, is it falsifiable? Can you fact check something and show that it's not real? I can show you Barack Obama's long form birth certificate. I can show you the 1961 announcement in a Hawaiian newspaper that says that he was born then. Do you have to believe a convoluted conspiracy with no evidence in order to believe the thing that you're being told? That's certainly part of it. And then you take a step back and you think about the journalistic ethics of the source. If I were writing an opinion column, it's going to have facts and information in it. And if I get something wrong, the source that I'm writing for is going to publish a correction. So when you're caught out saying something that isn't true, which we all do at times because we always make mistakes, do you allow room for correction, or do you just continue to double down and feed into a set of conspiracies and talking points? It's not a perfect system, but certainly, like, can something be disproved? And if it is, you continue to say it, seems like a pretty good, very low bar that should be cleared.
I completely agree with you. But I mean, it's interesting given that, you know, going right back to the beginning of this conversation about the zero evidence to support the Trump assertion that the election was stolen. And yet, depending on what polling you believe, half of the Republican voters of the 75 million people that voted for Trump believe that, notwithstanding no evidence. So it's very difficult to break down a belief structure, no matter what evidence you present. How do you go about convincing others of the truth? And because I think objectively we can assert what's fake and what's real, but if it's bumping up against a belief, it becomes very difficult.
Yeah, I mean, I can give you the descriptive difference between opinion and misinformation, but when it comes to actually addressing this, I mean, this is probably one of a handful of problems that we need to fix in order to rescue or rebuild American democracy, because there is no quick fix for it. Like, I'm never going to be trusted as a source of information by somebody who doesn't trust people who vote for Democrats. Like, that becomes a disqualifier.
We should have cleared this up before we got you on the podcast.
But do you know what I mean? Like, when there is, when we're talking not about sort of analytical look at a series of facts and evidence, but we're talking about a belief system, when we're talking about faith claims aren't something that I can come in with data and overturn. Because it's something that's core to your identity. It's something that you believe and often believe against evidence. And that's what gives it its power. So I don't think that there is an easy answer for this. I think to the extent that society has any impact on this, like that there's something that we can do to reverse it, it's about de-incentivizing it. People believe things because they get something out of it. And political leaders say things because they get something out of it. And media companies operate in certain ways because they get something out of it. And so you can see at least being able to nibble at the edges by demonetizing conspiracy theories, by not amplifying them. But how do you change, for instance, political incentives for a political party where the more extreme you are, the more votes you get, the more money you get, and the more power you get? That's a pretty hard thing to break up.
And so, you know, we've talked a bit about social media, and we've talked a lot about the ecosystem, but what is the role of social media companies in again, gatekeeping some of this? And you know, up until now, they've been very hands-off. Last week, we've seen some pretty heavy-handed stuff. Trump's been banned from Twitter, Facebook, et cetera. Parler's been deplatformed, which is a right-wing sort of, I suppose, a right-wing version of Twitter, if you want to call it that, from Google and Apple's app stores. I mean, one, is that appropriate? Two, is it too late? Three, what is the right response? Again, hard question, but, yeah, take a shot at it.
Yeah, I think that at least some of it was appropriate. I mean, if somebody is making threats on your platform and inciting violence on your platform, you have a moral responsibility to do something about that. I think that had the president been allowed to stay on Twitter, it would have been much worse over the last, I think we're 6 days out now, over the last 6 days, would have been much more tumultuous, would have been much more dangerous, frankly. And over on places like Parler, I mean, why did Parler get taken down? Because there were people calling for the execution of the vice president. There were people circulating bomb manuals because there were people calling for more violent insurrection and revolution in the United States. Those are the kinds of things that perhaps you don't want to be associated with. And so you take them down or you withdraw your support from them. That's probably not a long-term solution for all of this. And there needs to be a broader reckoning, because one of the things that these social media companies have done is they have made an extraordinary amount of money building a system that they have known for years is involved in radicalization and the spread of terroristic violence in the United States and other countries. Sites like Gab that have spread far-right violence and have led to massacres, but also just on Twitter, right? The amplification of anti-Semites and alt-right figures in the buildup to Donald Trump's election, the way that these platforms have been hacked for spreading disinformation as well as misinformation around elections and around other parts of American political life. These companies have a responsibility for tweaking their systems so that they make less money, but they damage democracy less. And perhaps they're starting to get that message. Who knows? But there is an accounting that has to happen, because even though this isn't at root a technological problem, technologies have enabled and have exacerbated many of these problems over the past 5 to 10 years.
So some people would say, you know, you're better off, these opinions exist, you're better off seeing them, hearing them, knowing that they're there. And also, I suppose, you know, in a more libertarian approach to freedom of speech, marketplace of ideas, bad ideas get discredited, good ideas get promoted, et cetera. But rather than giving a faux legitimacy to something by saying, well, that's, you can't talk about that. So then it was, oh, well, of course they won't let us talk about this thing because, you know, it's too true. Where's the balance there in this tech debate, do you think? Or is there, are there things that are so bad that they should just be, I suppose, stamped out of the public discourse?
So this is really difficult because one of the big problems with the way these things have been platformed is that they have been pushed into people's feeds and they've been put before people who never asked for them to be there in the first place. If you went on Twitter every day and you just got a flood of pornography, it would be a very, very different experience. And it might draw a different group of people to Twitter and it would drive another group of people off of Twitter. But Twitter doesn't let you do that. You don't actually get to post whatever you want on these internet sites. And the same thing should be true for violent anti-Semitism, violent white power ideology. Like, we should not be setting up structures that pushes this in front of a 13-year-old kid, that pushes this stuff in front of journalists, that pushes this stuff in front of somebody who's like having a bad day and suddenly falls down a radicalization rabbit hole, which is not to take agency away from people for searching this out and for engaging in these conversations and for embracing these ideas. But we've studied this. That's what happened. You went on YouTube and you wanted to hear a mildly conservative voice talk. And then the next video that was offered to you was a more radical right voice. And then on and on and on until you're either on Alex Jones's conspiracy sites or on Richard Spencer's neo-Nazi sites. And that's the problem that we need to address first. And then we can talk about like what our tolerance should be for debating, as Richard Spencer would like us to do, whether Jews are people. I don't think that's a conversation that I think we should be hosting, but that person doesn't necessarily go to jail just for saying that. So there's a spectrum, but I think we can at least tackle the distribution problem.
And so I just wanted to zoom out a little. You know, this show, we talk a lot about foreign policy and sort of global issues. So just sort of want to talk about, you know, the global network of right-wing misinformation. You're seeing, so we spoke very specifically about the United States, but, you know, we're seeing a lot of these same issues pop up in Australia, see other countries. Of course, you had the awful shooting massacre in New Zealand, which, you know, was deeply linked to the sort of conspiracy theories you saw on things like 4chan, 8chan, et cetera. And, of course, was live streamed on social media. I mean, how concerned are you about this global network effect of misinformation, radicalization, and all those problems that we've talked about in the United States context?
Pretty concerned. I mean, it's something that I think, especially in the U.S., which has a very parochial view of its political problems, we don't talk about enough. But in particularly far-right racist circles, radicalization draws its inspiration from the mass shooting that happened, I think, in Sweden, the one that happened in New Zealand, from right-wing terror around the world. Take somebody like Dylann Roof, who was the person who massacred 9 Black people in their church back in 2014 or 2015. He wore on his shirt 2 flags, the flag of the Confederacy and the flag of Rhodesia. And that kind of Rhodesia, which had been an apartheid state, and drawing that inspiration from other countries. In Charlottesville, what flags did you see? You saw the Confederate flag, but you also saw the Nazi flag. And so drawing from historically racist regimes, drawing inspiration from racism and radicalism in other countries. I mean, this is not just a US problem. We're seeing the rise of a liberal right-wing nationalism and proto-fascism and fascism across the world right now in places like Turkey and in Russia and in Latin America. So this is not simply a US problem, but one that both at a leadership level and then also just at a population level, there are lots and lots of connections that cross borders, because the thing that ties them together is not their national identity, but are things like whiteness, radicalism, and an affection for fascism.
And so, you know, this is tangential and we could do an entire show on this one question by itself. But, you know, one of the things I'm very concerned about, and we talk a lot about on this with other guests, is that the way authoritarian regimes are using misinformation to pull apart democracies, I mean, how helpful were the events of last week to that effort, by the Russian regime, by the Chinese Communist Party to discredit democracy? And then secondly, where, you see funding in Europe and you see links between these authoritarian regimes and right, far right parties, how concerned are you about that link, and how can we sort of, I suppose, tackle that in some way?
So January 6th was a huge win for authoritarians across the world, no doubt about it. I mean, to the extent that the U.S. still has some moral authority when it comes to promoting the idea of democracy, to promoting civil rights, civil liberties, human rights, I realize that is something that the U.S. has ceded a lot of ground on over the past few decades, but it still has been at least one model of what liberal democracy could look like and what it looks like to defend people's rights. And that has made it an enemy of places, or a foe of places like China and Russia. And so to be able to point to the United States and say, that's what democracy looks like, right? They're killing one another in the streets. They're storming their capital. They tell you that civil liberties and human rights are going to get you to a better, more progressive, happier life. Do they look happy to you? That's powerful propaganda, and it is going to be used to spread illiberal and authoritarian ideas around the world. And it's pretty troubling that the United States is not only failing as an example of what a liberal democracy could look like, but is actually beginning to give us a sense of what it might look for a liberal democracy to turn into an illiberal state of some kind. And, you know, over the past week, we hear people like Turkey's Erdogan come out and wag his finger at the United States, and it legitimates these regimes that attack their own people. I live right now in a regime in the U.S. that has attacked its own people, regimes that strip people of their civil liberties and are collapsing into authoritarianism.
I suppose it also, it's like a writ large example of being able to say, well, look, oppression of Uyghurs in the Xinjiang province. Well, so what? Because, you know, the United States election was fraudulent. I mean, like, you can just start to, it becomes very difficult to draw the distinctions of morality on a global basis, which is...
And when you have a president who says that it's fine that you have concentration camps with Uyghurs in them, right? Like, it's not just that it's the failure of American democracy, but you have a president who's fine with authoritarian regimes violating other people's human rights. And that sort of sign-off from Donald Trump is, it's not great.
To put it mildly, yes, but right. The sort of last serious question I wanted to ask you, and it's probably, you could go either way, because I mean, you know, how does this get fixed? But also, are you hopeful that it can? Because I could, on the one hand, it's easy to paint the very dystopian future of the gradual descent into inevitable fascism, and you know, we can't find commonality, and we're all being pulled apart in information bubbles, et cetera, et cetera. The other hand, the more sort of dovish view is, well, you know, Biden won, you know, Trump was defeated, notwithstanding all the carry-on, notwithstanding the insurrection, democracy held, majority of the House and Senate voted to uphold the outcome, say everything should be okay. So, I mean, where do you sit within those? I suppose you'll probably say somewhere in the middle, which is probably fair, but kind of curious about how do you see it fixed, and are you hopeful that it can be?
Well, I will preface this by saying that I have always been just a real optimist, like somebody who believes that there are brighter days ahead, that there are bright silver linings around all of these clouds. That's changed a lot in the last 4 years. I would say that while I'm still bullish on democracy in the long term, I think that we have seen so many powerful examples of people not only standing up to Donald Trump's authoritarian tendencies, whether that was rushing to airports to protect people who had been caught up in the Muslim ban, or whether it was taking to the streets in order to stand beside people who had been harmed by police brutality, whether it was this multiracial coalition that has over the past several years again and again made its way to the polls in the face of voter suppression in order to turn out and have their voices heard. It's been a period of real grassroots democracy in the United States that's inspiring. I would say that I am a long-term optimist. I am a short-term pessimist. I don't think that January 20th rolls along and all of a sudden it's just daisies and sunshine and rainbows everywhere. I think that this problem of domestic terrorism and political violence are going to escalate in the coming years. I don't think that the Capitol attack is the end of this. I think it's the beginning of a new phase of it. It was seen as a victory by far right groups, and they are eager to get out there and try something again. And I don't think that American democracy is in very good shape. We did manage to get through this election, but by a hair, 147 Republicans, after the Capitol building was attacked, stood on the floor of the Congress and they voted to overturn a duly elected president. That is not good. That is democracy in very, very serious shape, and a sign that the people who have been elected to represent us are not necessarily all that interested in fixing it, at least a good proportion of them. And so, you know, I think there are a lot of people who understand now in a way that they didn't before how fragile and how necessary democracy is, but they are facing some very strong opponents and some very long odds in the next 5 to 10 years. So this is a generational fight that Americans need to be engaged in, and one that they have to be engaged in if that optimistic vision of a flourishing just democracy is something that we hope to have.
It is a hard one, isn't it? Because it's an internal foe in a contestable system. And then you've got perhaps a psychology of perpetual struggle amongst this sort of Trumpy base. I mean, it's not like where World War II, the examples you used before, where it was, you know, a discredited ideology that was crushed literally in war, or even in the United States, to use other examples, Civil War, where, you know, again, the Confederacy was defeated. It's difficult to defeat sort of an almost an unseen enemy in this way. It's very challenging.
Yeah, and in a two-party system, if one of the parties radicalizes but still maintains the ability to get close to 50% of the vote, it sort of enables radicalism in that way, right? Because it's not shunted away into a third party. Everyone who votes for a Republican right now is voting to continue to uphold this ideology that has taken over the party. And so our two-party system, I think, is working against us in some ways, because while it may only be 30% of Americans who have turned their backs on democracy and embraced conspiracy theories because they make up the majority of one of the political parties, that's going to be an ongoing problem for us, I think.
Would you advocate for, you know, I suppose, whether be they, I suppose, traditional Republicans or Democratic activists who actively target this list of Congress and Senate candidates that, that have voted, I suppose, against democracy to overturn the election, should they be actively targeted for that in elections?
Yes. Yes, I think that at the bare minimum, one thing you should commit yourself to, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, if you believe in democracy, it is getting out of office people who don't believe in democracy. I think that that's a bare minimum starting point. And if we can create a liberal democracy alliance that is made up of people who believe in the continuation and the protection of democracy, I think you get more than a majority of more than 50% of the American people. And you're committed to something that I think Americans need to display their commitment to if they're committed to it. And that means Republicans as well. Like if you're running up, the problem with all of this is that it's so easy to report on it and to talk about it as though it's Republican versus Democrat and liberal versus conservative, because the people who are trying to overthrow democracy are all located in one party. But it isn't a question of conservatism versus liberalism. It's a question of liberalism versus illiberalism. And we have to start talking about this problem in those terms, or we're going to continue to confuse things. And that's going to be a real barrier to change.
Well, that's a very profound place to end the serious part of this conversation. I could, of course, could go all day, but you've got a life to get back to in New York, and I, you know, need to sort of release our listeners. But, you know, conspiracy theories, capital insurrection, you know, right-wing media misinformation. Now, just to pivot slightly to lighter, more on-point topics, you're a foreign guest of the show, and so thank you for coming on. But one of the compulsory questions I have, it's a very extremely lame question, but everyone has answered it thus far, so you are also obliged to. Three Australians at a barbecue at Nicole's, who are they and why?
All right. Well, I will say that I lived in Sydney during 2011, 2012. Right. So I have a little bit of exposure. So the first person I'm going to choose comes from the time that I lived there, and that's Julia Gillard. I'm really interested in women in politics and women in power, and to be able to just sit down with her and pick her brain for a while would be kind of amazing. I would also pick Indira Naidoo, because not only do I think that she would be really fun, I think she could make sure that we had delicious food at our barbecue. And then I think I have to pick one of the Hemsworths, right? I'm going to go with Chris, and I don't think I need to explain why.
It's for his sharp insights into misinformation campaigns and, you know, his democratic ideals, no doubt.
Clearly, it's because we're part of a pro-democracy coalition.
Well, you can do it up in Byron Bay, which is where all the celebrities are these days. So, yeah, that sounds like a good venue for it. Well, thank you so much, Nicole, for joining us. And I really appreciate you coming on the show and giving up your time.
Great. Thank you so much for having me. This is great.
G'day, Diplomates fans. I hope you enjoyed that episode as much as I did. Big thanks to Nicole for coming on the show and sharing her insights. If you enjoyed Nicole, jump on Twitter, follow her on Twitter at PassPunditry. It's also in the show notes. Make sure you tune in, subscribe to a couple of her podcasts. They are outstanding. You really enjoy them. As ever, I have committed to answering a question from listeners. I've got a few stacked up due to the hiatus, so I do apologize, but I will answer one today from John. John asks, what should President Biden do as his first act? It's a good question. I spent a bit of time thinking about this. A lot of people, given the events of last week and what we just discussed in this episode, people would say, oh, we should impeach Trump. Firstly, I think that'd be a mistake for Biden. Secondly, it's really an act of the House and the Senate to impeach a president, sitting or former. So I think Biden should focus on making government work for people that voted for him and who didn't vote for him. So a big frustration, I think, amongst many people is that does voting matter? Can governments change things? Can there be a link between voting, changing government, changing leaders, and outcomes for voters, outcomes for people? And so the big thing that I would encourage an incoming Biden administration to do is to lift the minimum wage in the United States. So currently the minimum wage is around $7 an hour. It should be lifted to $15 an hour. And so if you lifted people's wages, if you doubled people's wages overnight, that's profound, life-changing circumstance for people. So if you can actually change people's lives materially through acts of government quickly, you can say, you vote for Joe Biden, your wages, if you're a minimum wage worker, double. That's transformative. It would be a huge life-changing event for so many working people who currently are working poor. And if you work, you should never be poor. And also, it would be a huge boost to the economy, as you'd put a lot of money in the hands of people that are going to spend it. So I think both as a equality measure, as a building faith in democracy measure, and also as an economic stimulus measure, it makes so much sense. And you can say to people, there's a proof point, government works. So if I had the ear of Joe Biden, that's exactly what I'd be encouraging him to do. Now, also, before I go, I should encourage you to do your homework. If you haven't done it, or if you're new to the show, it helps. It really, really helps in podcasting land. If you can jump on iTunes, jump on your favorite app, rate the show 5 stars. Give a review about what you think about the show more generally. Love it, don't love it, whatever. It really does help spread the word. If you can share the episode around too, that also really helps gain that algorithm and get me up the charts and get more people listening to the show. Once again, thanks for tuning in. I'll see you next time. Cheers.
You were just listening to Diplomates, a geopolitical chinwag. For more episodes, visit www.diplomates.show or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or through any of your favorite podcast channels.
This podcast was brought to you by Minimal Productions, producer Jim Mintz.